It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, vaccine wars. Two words you don't want to hear in a sentence together. Measles and Disneyland. That's where the new vaccine debate started, but who knows where it'll end.
I was reading a local paper recently and something caught my eye. Marquette Elementary School, where my kid goes, has a 13.8% non-vaccination rate. 13.8. That's a lot of unvaccinated kids.
Charles Monroe Kane is one of our producers. The measles outbreak that started in Disneyland and has so far spread to 17 states seemed kind of far away to him until he realized that some of his own neighbors aren't vaccinating their kids. Turns out he's living in a cluster of anti-vaxxers.
We're sitting in her living room. One kid's banging a plastic top on my leg. Another one's playing a video game in a different room. And the youngest, he's peering down at us from a stairwell. The oldest boy is vaccinated, the middle child is partially vaccinated, and the youngest boy, he is not vaccinated at all.
6, 4, and 19 months.
Yeah, you're just worried about getting sleep, I would assume. You're more worried about the vaccinations.
Oh, sleep. What's that?
You remember it? Don't think about it. It's just going to get upset. Don't even think about it.
I think I might remember what that was.
We aged so much in those beginning years. Wow. There are measles in Michigan, Chicago, and in Minnesota. Will you feel differently about your decision if Dane County has a case of measles?
I actually looked at this. Mm-hmm. The year that he was born, there was a measles case in Madison. And I think I remember hearing about it like one time, and that was it. It was the one case, and then it was done. And I'm not too worried about it. Not too worried about it.
Like, you won't immediately get your kids vaccinated if you hear there's measles in Dane County?
No, I wouldn't run out and vaccinate. I don't like to do things quite on a whim like that.
Oh. So if there is an outbreak, then your children would be more vulnerable, so to speak.
Oh, yeah. I never dispute that. I don't think I'd be especially afraid of it, though, because it's very low chance that they'll have any type of severe reaction. They'll be a bit miserable for a few days. And then they'll have immunity to it, and then they won't have to worry about it anymore. I'm not going to ever purposely expose them to anything, so no measles parties here.
No parties to intentionally spread measles for immunity at her house. But with a 13.8% non-vaccination rate at my kid's school, there might be an unplanned measles party, like it or not. I called up Sally Zerbel-Donish to find out what might happen if there's an outbreak. She's the director of health services for the Madison Metropolitan School District. I was wondering what Marquette Elementary would do if measles showed up. I asked her if she had a plan.
We definitely do have a plan, and, you know, we've sent letters out. Families are aware that, let's say at Marquette, there is a student who has measles. So students who are not properly immunized would be excluded from school.
What's your worst-case scenario for the school district? Say for Marquette, what would be a worst-case scenario for you?
Well, I think the worst case scenario would be that you would have measles that would spread, and it might spread to teachers, and, you know, you wouldn't have enough teachers to teach. And, I mean, I think that would be, you know, the situation where you might have to think about closing a school.
What Sally said really surprised me. My children are immunized, and I figured that meant that measles or any other disease you can vaccinate against wouldn't keep them out of school.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, you guys
want to
run
nice
around?
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Hello.
Maria Ruiz lives less than a block away from my house. Her kids play with my kids. She's also an ER doctor at one of the local hospitals. She told me that the vaccination question also affects the ER more than you'd think. When a child who hasn't been vaccinated comes into the ER for anything, they get a battery of tests other kids don't get. And they stay in the hospital longer for observation, too. But Maria says she can understand why some parents are worried about vaccinations.
You know, I'm a mom, so I get paranoid about things too. Like, is this Tylenol I'm going to give my child? Is it going to be tainted? You know, I have those fears too, just like a mom. But I don't want to ostracize or alienate those people. So I never really thought of it as, oh, those people are putting my child at risk or they're bringing disease into the schools. I never really thought of it that way. You know, my child is really healthy. She's fully immunized. I feel like it's my responsibility to my community. We do this as a community. This is a community thing.
After talking to Maria, I walked around the neighborhood thinking about this idea of the community, of immunization as some kind of altruism.
Hello.
Hey, Thomas.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Enter Happy Bambino.
Good.
It's a store for pregnant women and new mothers. They teach classes on breastfeeding and baby yoga. And if you have to buy your sister an environmentally friendly baby shower gift, Happy Bambino is the place. But its owners caused quite a stir recently when they posted a new store policy about the vaccine that includes measles, which is called MMR. Kids who are old enough to be vaccinated for measles and haven't been, they won't be welcome at Happy Bambino if there's a measles outbreak in Madison or in any of its neighboring communities. That goes for the siblings of unvaccinated children as well. Allison Dodge is one of the owners of Happy Bambino.
So, as you know, there's been measles outbreaks as close as Chicago, and there was a suspected case up in Stevens Point, a couple cases, and we started getting calls and emails from concerned parents wondering, you know, my kids are registered for classes there, you know, what if measles comes to Madison, what are you going to do? There are many, many infants, you know, under the age of 12 to 18 months, which is when you can first start to vaccinate for MMR, coming here every week. And measles is extremely contagious, and it can sort of stay in the air and on surfaces for several hours. So you imagine a class of, you know, kids in one of the rooms playing, and somebody's got measles, and then, you know, right after that, a group of babies comes into the room. There's a really high risk for, you know, transmitting the disease to, you know, a baby, and babies don't have fully developed immune systems, and, you know, it's dangerous.
It seems interesting to me, your philosophy here, mm-hmm. It's pretty radical and very empowering for women and for medical choices. And certainly that's the same type of demographic of person who isn't the person that vaccinates.
Right.
It was surprising, I think, to some people that you would take the stance in favor of the medical establishment on this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really about siding with anybody. It was just about babies. Like, really, it's just about kids that we don't want them to get measles. They could get sick, they could die, they could go deaf. It's, you know, I feel a big responsibility to protect everybody that comes here, and that's a huge group of vulnerable, you know, community members.
Okay, so that's how Happy Bambino would handle a measles outbreak in my community. We know how the school would handle it. But are anti-vax parents ready? Here's another local mom who's got a toddler and is pregnant with her second child. The vaccination debate is very contentious in my neighborhood, so she asked me not to use her name.
The measles don't scare me. I think historically the measles, definitely a lot of people died, but it was back in the time, if you look at the history of the disease, it was during the time when there was no sanitation and people just barely had anything to eat. So there's measles outbreaks in the Amish communities. There's measles outbreaks every year all over where people don't die. So it's not a death sentence. Yes, my daughter would get very sick. It would be a rough couple weeks, but I have, like, absolute faith that she'd get through it.
The plan, like with most of the anti-vaxxers, is to let their kids get sick and develop immunity by fighting off the disease. And I want to be clear here. Most of the moms I spoke with aren't just rejecting the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Most don't give their children any of the vaccines. Not diphtheria, not tetanus, not even polio. And most of them told me if there was a polio outbreak, they still wouldn't vaccinate their children. As one mom put it, they'd just ride out the storm. Even though the recent measles outbreak at Disneyland has spurred a national uproar, anti-vaxxers do not seem to be changing their minds.
I'm not swayed by that stuff because I've done so much research, because I feel very educated. And I feel like the media feeds into the fears of people that don't know. Most of the people I talk to who vaccinate and have a problem with me not vaccinating, they don't know what's in their vaccines. Their doctors don't tell them what's in the vaccines. They don't know what the risks are. They've never read the inserts. They have no idea. So to me, that's making a choice based on what everyone else is doing, what somebody is telling them to do, and what their fears are, but it's uninformed. And that's all I want, is like for people to make an informed choice. Like that's, and I think that's what a lot of anti-vaxxers want, is be informed.
With national attention on the vaccination question these days, are people really getting informed? You know, I've started to think that the debate could really be doing more harm than good. Like I said earlier, a lot of the moms I talked to didn't want me to use their names. They know that some of our neighbors are really upset that there are so many kids in the school district that aren't vaccinated. You know, I've seen friendships fall apart over this. Kids have been kicked out of playgroups. So many anti-vaxxers have just stopped talking about this altogether. As an anti-vaxxer friend told me, talking about not vaccinating would, quote, ruin my family. It's not worth throwing ourselves into that pit of hate and judgment. If anti-vaxxers feel they can't talk about their choices, how is the community going to deal with the fact that nearly 14% of our children are unvaccinated? Can anything sway them? Well, maybe one thing can. Hi, sweetie, how are you?
Good.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, come on in.
Can you show this microphone one of your little scars?
Scar? Chicken back.
Yeah.
Excellent. Can you tell the microphone what that is?
A chicken pox scar.
Was it yucky when you had it?
Yeah.
There's a duck that has a chicken pox.
Oh no, the duck had chicken pox too? Did he suffer?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, ducky. Did you take care of him? Were you a good mommy?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. My neighbor and her husband cherry-picked their children's vaccinations. They opted out of the chicken pox shot. Then, Dad got a severe case of shingles, which is related to chicken pox, and it's also contagious.
And ironically, I was talking about how, yeah, they're not vaccinated. We haven't seen any signs of it. It's been a few weeks. And somebody walked into the kitchen and said, so about your kids not having chicken pox, have you looked at your daughter? And sure enough, she comes in and she has spots on her. And then that following week was sheer hell, because one child had it very mildly. She sort of sailed in and out and was done. And then the other child was miserable. He got walloped and he was not sleeping at night and he was itchy and he was uncomfortable and he was kind of crazy in his own skin. And yeah, it was quite an experience, because now we had two sick kids and a sick adult in the house.
So you look back at this, you have one child with mild chickenpox, one child with serious chickenpox,
yeah.
A husband with shingles who dealt with that for months.
Right.
Do you regret not getting your vaccination? I mean,
I never expected these conditions. I thought, okay, kids and chickenpox, we've been, this is a rite of parenting passage, mm-hmm. really. You go through this. I just never expected it to be, I don't know, in the middle of the state budget starting and I'm deep in my work mode and I have a husband who's completely laid out and, you know, trying to deal with his own pain, and then I have two kids who suddenly fall sick. And so at one point I found myself just telling people, I probably would tell my friends, just get the damn vaccine. Don't put yourself through this.
After this experience, she's now planning on getting both of her children caught up in all their immunizations. But she hasn't started a domino effect. In fact, some parents in the neighborhood thanked her for giving their children chickenpox. One even passed it on to others at a chickenpox party.
Senior producer Charles Monroe Kane brought us that story. Charles, these neighbors who are deciding not to vaccinate their kids, do they fit the stereotype of the radical left, long-haired hippies?
No, not at all. The people you heard have PhDs. One of the people you heard has a PhD in biology. They just don't trust medicine on this issue.
You said you were surprised to discover how many anti-vaxxer parents there are in your neighborhood. So how did these numbers compare to the rest of the country?
Oh, it's super high. So we're at 13.8%, Marquette Elementary School. The state of Oregon, which has the highest non-vaccination rate
in the country,
the whole state, has 7.1%. So we're at 13.8%.
So if there was an outbreak of something more serious in your neighborhood, measles, mumps, something worse, what do you think would change? I mean, what would the reaction in your neighborhood be like?
You know, I want to say everybody will come together and we'll work it out, but I can't say that. I mean, I'll be honest. When I put this up, when I started this piece, I put up a piece on Facebook saying, hey, some of you guys who aren't anti-vaxxing, why don't you give me a call? I'm going to have you on a radio piece, not thinking what a controversy it was. And people on Facebook were like saying the F word to each other. These are all my neighbors who know each other. I can't believe you would reply, or who do you think you are risking my grandchildren or my children? Just that.
What I still don't understand, you said your neighbors are well-educated. They like science. Some of them have advanced degrees in the sciences. They go to doctors, not faith healers. Why What do they have against vaccines?
The common narrative I heard from the people in my neighborhood was this. My first birth experience was a terrible experience. It was medicalized. I got an epidural too early. I had to lie on my back. My doctor gave me a lot of advice I didn't agree with. And it was just a negative, over-medicalized experience. Then, their second kid, they have them at home, okay? They have the second kid at home with a midwife. It's a great experience. It's not over-medicalized. And it doesn't take a genius for them to sit back and compare these two experiences and say, medicine's at fault for why I had a bad experience here. I don't trust medicine fully. So, why would I trust them 12 months later when they say I have to get a bunch of vaccines?
Thanks, Charles.
You're welcome.
Charles Monroe Kane is our senior producer. By the way, if you want to know immunization rates in your state, he worked with the CDC to create a chart for kindergartens across the country. Just go to ttbook.org for that and a host of other immunization resources. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll dig into the history of vaccination fears and the science behind childhood immunization. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about vaccine wars in this hour. And to put today's debate in context, this isn't the first time fear of vaccination has led to popular resistance.
If you're looking at the anti-vaccine movement, it's a periodic thing that goes back to the 18th century, but in contemporary America, it goes back to the wholesale pertussis vaccine.
Arthur Allen is a science journalist and the author of A History of Vaccination.
The late 70s, early 80s, there were some reports in Britain and then later in the U.S. linking the vaccine to brain damage. Because it has endotoxin, it would cause a lot of fevers and it caused seizures sometimes. Kids would have seizures after this vaccine, and then a very tiny percentage of them would go on to have epilepsy or other like brain damage. And was that a direct connection or was it coincidental? And the government came in and Congress passed this bill, which created a vaccine injury compensation program, which exists to this day.
But so take us back to America's first big vaccine war, 1901. And this was, there's a huge smallpox epidemic in the U.S.
1901, you have the smallpox epidemic, but people aren't that concerned about it because most of the cases were not that serious. But what was worse, in this epidemic, tetanus was associated with the vaccine.
People were getting the smallpox vaccine, but then they'd contract tetanus as a result?
Exactly, exactly. And so there were, I forget, 80, 100 case deaths of children of tetanus that were associated with vaccination. The idea that you could actually, you know, contract tetanus caused a lot of uproar, and it built very quickly. There was an anti-vaccine movement, which had already sort of been germinal.
And to put this in some context, this was a time when in some places in the U.S. there were forced vaccinations, right?
They were coming into schools. They were coming into labor sites where there were immigrant laborers because then as now, but then even more baldly, people associated disease with foreigners and immigrants and, oh, those dirty Italians, let's go grab them and vaccinate them. You know, I mean, that was very common. It was very common. You would hear these reports of people chasing some poor, you know, stonemason around, you know, several blocks, catching him and jabbing him with the smallpox vaccine.
And how big a movement was this?
Well, I mean, it was across the country, and in Oregon, the state voted against or came very close to opposing vaccination requirements for schools, and there were other states where similar things happened. There were riots in certain cities.
Anti-vaccination riots?
Yes, there were. Yeah. And there were cases where, you know, police were called in to stop demonstrations that were going on.
So the medical community and the government obviously had a really powerful incentive to make vaccines a lot safer. What's changed since then?
Well, I mean, there's really no comparison. First of all, when a lot of these vaccines were being made, there was no federal scientific agency that looked at the safety. I mean, we're talking about before the establishment of safe monitoring of food or of drugs, anything. It's totally up to the drug companies to make sure this product is safe. So, you know, the changes, you know, have been radical. I mean, the NIH first and then FDA, you know, just have very stringent requirements for each lot. They check each lot of vaccine for safety and for its to make sure it is what it says it is. It's, you know, much more tightly regulated than most drugs, and certainly by like any of the supplements that people take by the handfuls in this country.
You know, there is something a little scary about taking your small baby and injecting them with stuff that you know is going to permanently change their immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us do remember stories about, like, the old live vaccines.
Well, we still have a live vaccine. The MMR vaccine is a live vaccine, and it gives you three transient infections with measles, mumps, and rubella. But we know, we've characterized what those infections are like so well, and it's one of the best vaccines that's out there because, in general, when you're vaccinated with a live vaccine, you get better immunity. You get more long-lasting immunity than you do with a killed vaccine or with a vaccine that's made of particles of an antigen, like the acellular pertussis vaccine. So I would agree, though, that there's something about injecting a healthy kid with anything because they're healthy and in a little while they might get sick or in a little while they might have developmental delays. There's all kinds of things that could happen to a kid. I mean, that's life. And so I think it's alarming to sort of feel like you're doing something and you don't know if something were to happen later to this kid or this kid would become ill in some way. And you, if you didn't have an answer to why that is, you're always going to feel like, oh, gee, maybe I shouldn't have vaccinated them. Mm. I mean, even with whatever the science is that shows you that vaccines are safe, there's the personal risk assessment that we do that comes from our guts. And that's really different from what we gather from data. It doesn't matter how much of a careful scientist you are. It's very hard to not feel those things in your gut.
We should pause here a moment and talk about how vaccines and the principle of herd immunity works. Because mm-hmm. I think people tend to think, well, I don't need to get my kid vaccinated because my kid is unlikely to be exposed to hepatitis B or any of the, by now, laundry list of things that we immunize children against.
Mm-hmm.
But the principle isn't just your kid. It's about the public safety, the public good, right?
Right. So your kid is, I mean, I remember when this vaccine compensation program was put into effect in the late 80s, somebody, a bioethicist, said something to the effect of, all of our children are basically, we're asking them to be soldiers in this war against infectious disease. For every kid out there who's a wall against disease, that's a wall that the disease can't spread through to somebody who, for whatever reason, is not protected. That's the whole idea of herd immunity, that it's a public effort. It's not only protecting your own kid, it's being part of this gigantic effort involving millions of children and adults to protect the people who can't be vaccinated or for whom the vaccine didn't work or older people. I mean, it's interesting, like the pneumonia rate among older people went down significantly when we instituted pneumonia vaccination of infants. And that was one of the biggest health impacts of vaccinating little kids against strep pneumonia was what it did for their grandparents.
Well, so thinking about the contemporary anti-vaccination movement, we should talk about the Wakefield study. So this is a study that Andrew Wakefield did that first raised the idea that kids who were getting the DTP vaccine.
No.
Oh, sorry,
no,
not DTP.
DTP. But see, this is important because these things get crossed and confused all the time to where you talk to anti-vaccine people and they say, well, the MMR vaccine had mercury in it. It doesn't. Anyway, go ahead. Sorry.
All I remember as a parent is that at one point there were a lot of parents worried that one of the basic vaccines we were giving our kids was causing autism in some kids.
Right. And that was the MMR vaccine. Wakefield had this pet theory that measles vaccine both caused a gut disease and eventually he believed it caused autism. And so he conducted this study that was very poorly done. He didn't blind the controls. It's just a very, very poor study that was later withdrawn from the Lancet, which published it. And also he had created a patent for a single measles vaccine. And so this study, which didn't really convince anybody in the scientific community, but he held a news conference in which he said he would recommend them switching to a single measles vaccine after he had patented one. Mm. From start to finish, he has conducted his research very poorly, and he's basically been thrown out of the profession. He still has people who are believers who are convinced that their kids were damaged by the measles vaccine.
So is there actually any correlation between childhood vaccination and autism?
No, there isn't. There's many, many studies that show there isn't.
Don't you think that this is also playing out against a backdrop of distrust of the way American healthcare has medicalized so many natural conditions? You know, we have to a certain extent medicalized pregnancy. And I think people are distrustful, and, you know, they're tired of doctors throwing in the mainstream medical community, throwing, you know, big medicine at things that probably should be left alone.
People may believe that, and it may be true in some cases. And I think people have to realize that you don't live in a natural world. And the natural world is really nasty. And the natural world results in very high rates of infant death at very low life expectancy. So you have to pick and choose, you know, as a rational person, what you think are the right interventions, the right uses of big medicine or small medicine or whatever kind of medicine you want to use to improve your life, because you recognize that you're not sort of living on the plains with our hair streaming free in teepees. And, you know, if you want to live like that, you can, but I don't think it's overall it's going to benefit you in sort of these basic ways.
Arthur Allen is the editor of eHealth at Politico. He's also the author of Vaccine: The Controversial Story of Medicine's Greatest Lifesaver.
My son is fully vaccinated, but there's one immunization on the standard schedule that he didn't receive on time.
Eula Biss, the author of On Immunity, An Inoculation.
This was meant to be his very first shot, the Hep B administered to most babies immediately after birth. In the months before my son was born, while I was teaching at the university and hauling a used crib through the snow and moving bookshelves to make room for the crib, I began spending my evenings reading articles about immunization. I was already aware, before I became pregnant, of some fears around vaccination, but I was not prepared for the labyrinthine network of interlocking anxieties I would discover during my pregnancy, the proliferation of hypotheses, the minutiae of additives, the diversity of ideologies. Finding the reach of my subject had far exceeded the limits of my late-night research by the time my baby was due, I visited the pediatrician I had chosen to be my son's doctor. A number of friends had offered his name when I asked for a recommendation, and so had my midwife, who referred to him as left of center. When I asked the pediatrician what the purpose of the Hep B vaccine was, he answered, "That's a very good question," in a tone that I understood to mean this was a question he relished answering. Hep B was a vaccine for the inner city, he told me, designed to protect the babies of drug addicts and prostitutes. It was not something, he assured me, that people like me needed to worry about. All that this doctor knew of me then was what he could see. He assumed correctly that I didn't live in the inner city. It didn't occur to me to clarify for the doctor that although I live in the outer city of Chicago, my neighborhood is very much like what some people mean when they use the term inner city. In retrospect, I'm ashamed by how little of his racial code I registered. Relieved to be told that this vaccine was not for people like me, I failed to consider what exactly that meant.
That's Eula Biss reading from her book On Immunity, An Inoculation. The book is part journalism, part social criticism, and part memoir. And as the conflict between those who vaccinate and those who don't increases, her book takes us deeper into the philosophy and the metaphor of immunity. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with her.
Eula, why do you think so many people are scared of vaccinations, even people who are educated and usually trust what scientists tell us?
probably the one that I find most often when I'm talking to other parents is just a deep suspicion and mistrust of the government and the medical system. And since vaccine recommendations are made through a collaboration between the government and the medical system, parents feel reluctant to follow those guidelines.
Well, obviously, this is a subject that hit home for you. I mean, going back to when you were pregnant and, you know, when your son was very young. I mean, you know, should you give him all the prescribed vaccinations? Were you worried about the MMR vaccine that some people believe leads to autism?
You know, when I started this research, I didn't know enough to be worried about a particular vaccine. I knew almost nothing. All I knew was that I'd heard that some people had concerns, and that made me wonder whether I should look into the subject. But I think by the time I learned that there were concerns around the MMR, I'd already read the research that revealed that those concerns were unfounded, in science at least. So that one was not a particular concern for me. And actually, the fears of autism were perhaps the easiest fears to lay to rest for me. That research I did rather quickly and efficiently compared to some of the more diffuse fears, you know, fears that there's some sort of pharmaceutical corruption that's contributing to the number and kind of vaccines we give. That fear is harder to research than a specific fear about a specific vaccine causing a specific disease.
So you're suggesting that the fears are probably not really about the medical risk. I mean, there's something else going on here.
Oh, yeah. I don't think so. You know, after spending a lot of time with this subject, I think that part of what is so confusing about this subject and gets us confused almost every time we discuss it in kind of public discourse is that we conduct this conversation using medical terms and using scientific terms, using language from science and information from scientific inquiry, but it's not about medicine or science as far as I can tell. I think it's about other preoccupations, our feelings about government and government oversight and regulation. There's also feelings about environmental pollution that come into this. There's feelings about the history of sexism in medicine that come into this subject. More often than not, what we're really talking about when we're talking about this subject of vaccination is something extra medical.
Well, and we should point out, too, that, I mean, there is a chance that something can go wrong. Something seriously could go wrong.
Yes, there is. I was very humbled when I looked back through the history of vaccination by the tremendous risks that mothers used to take to vaccinate their children. So both variolation and 19th century vaccination against smallpox were tremendously dangerous, excuse me, by our standards. Even the modern smallpox vaccine that, say, my father received is orders of magnitude more dangerous than all the vaccines that are on the childhood schedule now. That vaccine against smallpox carries a 1 in a million risk of death. For a vaccine, that's a very, very high mortality rate. We don't have any other vaccine in use today that is as dangerous as that smallpox vaccine. And so there are definitely risks associated with vaccination. And those risks have been well studied, and there's an abundance of literature on them. So a few years ago, the Institute of Medicine did a meta-study where a team of medical experts looked at all the research on vaccine side effects. This was 12,000 articles that they read through, and it took them 2 years, a team of 18 medical experts, and their task was to try to figure out what side effects are caused by vaccination. And they did come up with a list of side effects that they know are caused. In many cases, those side effects are relatively mild. Fevers, rashes. One of the side effects of the chickenpox vaccine is that you can get chickenpox from it. And then there's some much rarer but quite serious side effects. There is a possibility that people with compromised immune systems can get a serious condition from the measles vaccine. And people who have very, very severe allergies run a risk of side effects from vaccines, in that many vaccines are grown in an egg medium, and people who have a very intense allergy to eggs might react to those vaccines.
So to some degree, I mean, you might be better off if you didn't give your child a vaccine. I mean, there is this tiny risk there, but I mean, part of the issue is what you should do for your own children and what you're doing for the common good. And it would seem that that's part of the problem here, is some people, you know, are basically getting a free ride because so many other people are getting the vaccines.
Yeah, though I think there is something a little misleading in that line of thinking, in that by the numbers, you aren't necessarily better off not vaccinating your child. If you look at the risk of getting a side effect from a vaccine versus the risk that a unvaccinated child runs of getting an infectious disease, the risk of getting the infectious disease is still higher than the risk of suffering a side effect. So I feel very strongly about the kind of altruistic reasons to vaccinate. I do think that when you make the decision not to vaccinate, you're making a decision not just for your child, but for everyone that your child's going to be in contact with. And that's one reason in my mind to vaccinate. But you don't need to be altruistic to see a good reason to vaccinate either. I think that there's also self-serving reasons to use this technology.
There are a few countries like Nigeria and Pakistan that have real problems with certain diseases like polio. If everyone got vaccinations, they could probably wipe out polio. But there has been a lot of resistance to getting vaccines. And it would seem in some cases, at least in Pakistan, there might be good reasons for for people to be mistrustful of the healthcare workers there. I mean, the CIA used a fake vaccination campaign to try to find Osama bin Laden.
Yeah, the idea to use a fake vaccination campaign to try to track down Osama bin Laden was astonishingly poorly planned. This was in a region where there's already some suspicion of Western medicine and of government interference in people's lives. It's also in a region where there's a lot of instability, economic and political instability. And when we used vaccination as a form of espionage, we really broke an important link of trust and did some real damage in that region. So the lady health workers of Pakistan had already been dealing with the Taliban for some years before this happened, and had already been dealing with threats against their lives. And once the kind of fears and suspicions of what was really going on with vaccination seemed to be confirmed by its association with the CIA and with the U.S. government, this put the health workers, the lady health workers who were administering vaccinations, in real danger.
And some were killed, right?
Many were murdered, yeah. At least 20 were murdered. And this is tragic not just for this country, of course, but for all the neighboring countries and really ultimately the world, in that polio does not obey our borders or our national distinctions. So it moves through populations quite quickly and easily. So anywhere where there's a disruption in vaccination coverage, polio will move fairly quickly into that population. So very soon after vaccination was disrupted in Pakistan, polio moved into Syria. And there were, of course, political and economic reasons why vaccination was disrupted there. So there was a vulnerable population, and polio began paralyzing children in Syria almost immediately. And this is one of the reasons that this conversation about whether we're going to vaccinate or not is, in fact, not just a national conversation, but a global conversation. What we as individuals do with our bodies affects our immediate communities, but it also affects the world community. It affects the places where we travel. It affects people that we never even anticipate coming into contact with.
That's Eula Biss talking with Steve Paulson. Her book is called On Immunity, An Inoculation. And we really want to know what you think. Do you vaccinate your kids? Why or why not? Visit our Facebook page and we'll moderate a civil conversation there. And coming up, it's a big day when Kazuo Ishiguro has a new novel out, but it's startling some of his fans. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. A new book by British writer Kazuo Ishiguro is a big event for his fans. It's been a decade since the last one, and so a lot of us have been really excited to get hold of the new one, called The Buried Giant. There's just one thing. It's high fantasy. There are knights in chainmail, ogres and pixies, and even a she-dragon. This is not what fans expect from Ishiguro. But he told Steve Paulson that he used the ogres and pixies to deal with the same themes he always has, memory and violence. Here's an excerpt from The Buried Giant.
Ogres were not so bad, provided one did not provoke them. One had to accept that every so often, perhaps following some obscure dispute in their ranks, a creature would come blundering into a village in a terrible rage, and despite shouts and brandishings of weapons, rampage about injuring anyone slow to move out of its path, or that every so often an ogre might carry off a child into the mist. In one such area, on the edge of a vast bog, in the shadow of some jagged hills, lived an elderly couple, Axel and Beatrice. Perhaps these were not their exact or full names, but for ease this is how we will refer to them. For warmth and protection, the villagers lived in shelters, many of them dug deep into the hillside. This elderly couple lived on the outer fringes of the warren, and hardly benefited from the fire in the great chamber where everyone congregated at night. Perhaps there had been a time when they had lived closer to the fire, a time when they had lived with their children. In fact, it was just such an idea that would drift into Axel's mind as he lay in his bed during the empty hours before dawn, his wife soundly asleep beside him, and then a sense of some unnamed loss would gnaw at his heart, preventing him from returning to sleep.
Ah, that is wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks.
Now, Ish, can you tell me about this world you've created? It's some mix of myth and history set before England had really forged its identity as a nation. Why did you decide to create this setting for your story?
Well, yes, I mean, just to explain where historically it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be after the Romans have left Britain. That's around 410 AD, but before the Anglo-Saxons, the people who eventually become the English, have settled the country. The Anglo-Saxons are landing in ever greater numbers around the country, but they haven't yet settled it. That's to say, they haven't conquered it. Now, historians have they have many arguments about this. No one knows what happened in that blank period of British history, but one theory is that there was a wipeout of the indigenous people and the Anglo-Saxons took over. There was kind of what we would today call an ethnic cleansing. Hmm. And in a very short period of time, the indigenous Britons disappeared. They were either massacred or they fled. Okay, so I've set my story down historically in that time, but...
Of the appeal, that there wasn't that much known historically about it, so you kind of had a blank canvas?
It's not so much that, but what I was looking for, what I really needed from my setting was a place where different ethnic tribes had, at least for a generation, coexisted in peace. An uneasy peace, probably a peace imposed by some kind of force and dictatorship. And then suddenly something erupts and one side wipes out the other. Okay, so that's the scenario I wanted. And the crucial thing that interested me was the idea that some piece of societal memory had been reawakened to mobilize the hatred and the violence. And I suppose, I mean, you're asking me, you know, what drew me to such a setting. Okay, this is on the surface a kind of an ancient, semi-mythological kind of setting.
Right.
But what triggered it for me were a number of things that happened in the 90s, particularly on our doorstep, you know, where I live in Britain. Yugoslavia disintegrated in the early 1990s. And it was amazing to see in a place where we were used to going on vacation and things like this, concentration camps and a massacre, like the one that occurred at Srebrenica.
And this was also the era when the massacres happened in Rwanda, too.
Exactly, yeah. In both of those cases, we have people who are using each other as babysitters, you know, living in the same neighborhood, same villages. You know, one group suddenly remembering, in quotes, I guess, reasons to hate the other group. In the case of Bosnia, powerful people had very deliberately reawakened memories from the Second World War. But on the other hand, there was one positive example of a country around that time who got that balance between how much, you know, should a nation remember, how much should a nation forget. It got it just about right, I feel, and that was South Africa as it came out of the apartheid regime. For a time, it seemed inevitable that that country would descend into civil war, but it didn't, I mean, partly because of remarkable leadership. But there was a very deliberate process. The Truth and Reconciliation Committee was a very deliberate means by which that nation went about balancing that question, a very difficult question, how much should you remember of the terrible things that had occurred?
Which is so interesting the way you phrase that, because it's not as if a country necessarily wants to remember everything. I mean, all the injustices, all the atrocities, you have to remember some of that, I mean, to acknowledge the truth of what happened. But maybe you also have to be willing to kind of gloss over some of those awful things that have happened.
Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. And that's very much what my book is about. I would say that there are often moments in any community's life when it's better to just forget things, to avoid just falling apart, you know, avoid cycles of violence, as we had, you know, near us in Britain, in Northern Ireland. I mean, people are deliberately keeping alive memories from even centuries back to fuel the hatred. But the analogy would be, and that's the case in my novel, The Buried Giant, with relationships. Mm-hmm. In something like a long marriage, which is at the center of my book, and my book is in many ways a kind of a love story about a long marriage. In a long marriage, you have exactly the same kinds of questions. There are inevitably dark passages that the two people in the marriage wish to just move on from.
Right. Do you really want to remember that really bad thing that happened 20 years ago?
Exactly, yeah. It may not be as simple as infidelity. It might be some bad thing that just happened. It wasn't anybody's fault. But sometimes you just have to move on. But, you know, this is the question that my couple, in my Axel and Beatrice, in my novel, face. On the one hand, would our love survive some of those buried memories coming alive again? But on the other hand, if we don't look at those buried things, is our love a phony one? Is it based on something false? Is it really a true love if it's actually based on just forgetting some things?
This question of memory keeps coming up in your novels. I mean, one thing that's often said about your books is, I mean, you never write the same novel twice. I mean, the style always changes. In this, you're clearly incorporating certain elements of fantasy, but you do have certain recurrent themes. And one is this question of what to do with memory, and especially cultural memories about things that are kind of awful that happened.
I suppose so, yeah. But maybe because of that, I like to change everything else. You know, I like to change even the genre.
Speaking of genre, I have to ask about this. I mean, you have ogres and you have a dragon in the story. You have certain magical elements. You've tapped into one of our oldest myths, King Arthur. One of your characters is Sir Gawain from King Arthur's Round Table. Is this a fantasy novel?
You could call it that, I suppose. I'm never very concerned about what actual official label you put on things. If you're saying that things like Beowulf or, the Odyssey, if you're saying they're fantasy, then definitely this book is fantasy. But
Well, Ursula Le Guin, of course, famous fantasy writer, blogged after she first heard you talking about it, and she seemed to think that you didn't want to be labeled a fantasy writer, and which she said was insulting and a thoughtless prejudice. And I think she may have backtracked after she made those comments.
Yeah, I don't want to restart the thing with Ursula K. Le Guin, who I respect a lot. And she was gracious enough to, without any prompting from me, to withdraw her, you know, actual personal accusation against me. But her larger point, I suppose, is that there's been a kind of snobbery on the part of the mainstream literary community towards the fantasy genre. And to some extent, I'm experiencing some of that for the first time since I published this book, because I have had people saying to me, you know, I love The Remains of the Day, I love Never Let Me Go, but I hear your new book has ogres and pixies in it. I'm not sure if I want to read your new book. And this slightly shocked me because, you know, when I was writing the book, I needed my pixies and my ogres for very strong artistic reasons.
Yeah, explain that. Why did you need these elements of what we might call the fantastic or the mythic to make this work? I mean, why couldn't you deal with these questions of mass killings and group hatred in a more realistic fashion?
Well, I had a story. As a novelist, I work around the story. And my story required a nation, a community that was suffering from some sort of strange amnesia. What appealed to me was to have some kind of old-fashioned, very old-fashioned, traditional fantasy reason. That, you know, there was a mist that had come over the land, and people were losing their memories. And so how I work is that, you know, I take anything available that will make my story work. But if lines are being drawn about, you know, whether pixies and ogres are good things for literature, I'm on the side of the pixies and ogres. They're there for very big reasons in my book.
Kazuo Ishiguro, talking with Steve Paulson about his new novel, The Buried Giant. And that's it for today's show. Hey, To the Best of Our Knowledge is a radio show, but also a podcast. And I don't know where you go to find podcasts you love, but if you haven't added us to your playlist, what are you waiting for? To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show. He had help from Brittany True, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and Sarah Nix. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.